Hundreds of years ago, long, long time ago, Zen poet Han Shan from the Tang Dynasty, he wrote this. Anger is fire in the mind, burning up the forest of your merits and blessings. If you want to walk the path of the bodhisattvas, endure insults, and guard your mind against anger. Anger is fire in the mind. An uncontrolled anger is uncontrolled fire. So it was a Wednesday night back in May of this year, when my younger cousin was home in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he was there with my older cousin and my aunt, when suddenly there was a loud knock on the door. You could see the police cars in the yard, lights twirling through the living room. So my aunt quietly opened the door and asked the three police officers that were there to come inside. They said they were there to serve a warrant for the arrest of my younger cousin because apparently a crime had been committed the night before and he was the prime suspect. My aunt tried to get them to explain, no idea what they were talking about. But they weren't there to explain. Their job was to find the suspect, serve the warrant, and make the arrest. Well, the suspect, my younger cousin, was in his bedroom, my aunt told them. That seemed easy enough, except the officers wanted everybody to leave the house while they served the warrant and made the arrest. So go out onto the front lawn, they said. So my aunt and my older cousin went outside and waited for them to come out with my younger cousin, thinking it would be, you know, pretty straightforward process, knowing, of course, the mild nature of my younger cousin. So imagine their surprise when instead they hear three gunshots. It didn't become apparent what had happened until the three officers emerged from the house, and my young cousin did not. He didn't emerge because he was dead. Just like that. Needless to say, my family was consumed with uncontrolled anger. And they weren't alone. The entire community in Tulsa was consumed with anger, with rage. Just like in Ferguson and Baltimore and many other communities, 486 communities in just this past year. Consumed with anger, justifiably and necessarily, they would say. But if uncontrolled anger is an uncontrolled fire, then it is never necessary. It is never justifiable. Why? Three reasons. Anger is what gives us a false sense of power and control. Two, anger distracts us from the more vulnerable emotions that are too painful for us to feel. And three, because uncontrolled anger, all it does, all it can do, is destroy. It has one task, and one task alone, and that is destruction. So how does anger give us a sense of power and control? It was tax day, April 15th, 2010, when in his own voice, Timothy McVeigh confessed to the bombing of the Murrah building in Oklahoma. And he recounted to MSNBC everything from his childhood in Buffalo to his time in the military to the friendship he made with conspirator Terry Nichols to the planning and execution of the attack in Oklahoma City, attack that killed 168 people and left, as you probably recall, over 500 people injured. So Dan Burbeck of MSNBC interviewed Timothy, and he reported, "The ultimate thing that sent him toward Oklahoma City was Waco, the Branch Davidian people being killed, and he told us that that was the day. From that day forward, he decided he was going to become a terrorist." McVeigh believed, he was convinced, that he and the militia movement were now at war with the U.S. government. And he came up with this plan that he would respond to Waco by attacking a federal government building with law enforcement officers in it. His anger was blind to the fact that the Murrah building in Oklahoma also contained a daycare with 20 children in it. His anger was so hot. It was also blind to the fact that there were innocent people that were not law enforcement officers in that building as well. Waco was his source. Waco, he said. Waco started this war. Oklahoma City is going to put an end to it. And when asked, "What do you want? You know, what exactly do you want? What is this about?" He said the only way they're going to get the message, the only way they're going to feel something, is with a body count. Now, obviously, these are two pretty extreme ways in which anger can trigger a false sense of power and control, a false sense of energy to win a victory, to get going. Because it triggered a big response, a very emotional response in my family. And the bombing in Oklahoma City triggered a major response in our nation. We felt a different kind of fear after that bombing. Up until that point, we had always felt pretty safe in the United States and the homeland. But when we saw that building blow up in Oklahoma, some of you probably too young to remember, blown up by one of our own, we were paralyzed in disbelief. And then we got angry to help us deal with that fear. Now, most of us would never do something so terrible as that. We would never set off a bomb designed to kill people. We don't typically live at that extreme. But we do have our own special coercion tactics. We do know how to get someone to do something they don't really, really want to do, as if the ends justify the means. A guy says to his wife, he says, "When I get mad at you, you never fight back. How do you control your anger?" She said, "Well, I clean the toilet." He says, "Well, How does that help? She said, I use your toothbrush. Okay, so you're not Timothy McVeigh. You're not the three officers that showed up at our house. You're not Tony Soprano, I hope. But let's reflect for just a moment on the ways that you just might use anger to get your way. So for a moment, reflect with me. Your eyes closed. Just for a second, bring your attention inward. Now see if, when you go inside, see if there are ways in which you gain a stronger sense of power and control when you get really, really ticked off. Maybe when you look around, you find that anger gives you permission to close down and shut other people out. Just see if you can sense that aggression in your body, in your heart, in relations to others. So what is it like when you look inside to win your victory with anger? Does it bring you closer to the ones you love, or does it drive you farther apart? What is the quality of your relationships when anger or irritability take up most of the space? Does using that kind of power make the heart contract in fear or expand in love? See for yourself. Carlos Castaneda wrote, "To be awake is to walk the border between control and abandon." So in what way does my anger give me a false sense of power, of entitlement, victory, moral superiority? So opening your eyes when you're ready. So the next question, how does anger distract me from those deeper, more vulnerable emotions that are too painful for me to let myself feel? This is a very important question. Did you know that between 1973 and 2002, there were only 4 women out of every 1 million? And 2 men out of every 1 million to develop urethral cancer? It's such a rare, rare disease. The prognosis for this particular kind depends on the location of the cancer, the shape, the size, the stage, and the depth of the invasion. Apparently, deep invasive lesions are rarely curable despite the combinations of therapies that you use, including therapy or surgery to remove the sex organ, I found out. Well, about 2 years ago, I met one of the men out of the million with this disease. He was very, very, very angry. And he was only one out of the 1 million who had this particular deep invasive lesion. He was devastated, very young, by the surgery. and was almost immediately went from Mr. Prankster, Mr. Full of Life, Jokester, to acute clinical depression. But let's call him John, right? You wouldn't know that John was depressed. What you would be distracted by if you met him was how angry he was. I mean, this was the guy that would snap at waitresses. He was the guy that would flick off at flight attendants if you told him to turn his phone off. This is the same guy that would lean on his horn and, try to blast someone to go faster. He became that guy overnight with the surgery. What was easier than feeling the loss of his manhood, than dealing with the shame, the grief, and the vulnerability that he felt, was getting pissed off. And he could get pissed off. Every time his family tried to break through that wall of anger, to help him, to figure out, when's your next appointment? What'd the doctor say? What do we need to be doing? He got even more pissed off, more walled off. So one day, I just flat out asked him, what are you so angry about? What are you so pissed off about? He answered me with a look, just a look. But it was a look I recognized. I was on retreat years ago when I realized that I had been pretty angry most of my life. I was never the loud and obnoxious type. I didn't lean on my horn and snap at flight attendants, but when you get on retreat and you get pretty quiet, you start to see things. And I saw very clearly that I had always, on some level, I had always been looking for a fight. I was always finding something wrong with some person or some situation. Things were never quite good enough. So I recognized that look he gave me. I knew it. I knew what it meant. But listen to what Donna Markova wrote about what that look might indicate. She said, most people are afraid to feel what they're feeling because they have no idea what to do with it all. They're afraid of their fear, angry at their anger, and despairing about their despair. A great deal of what we call pain is actually resistance to pain. So imagine allowing your heart to open wide enough, to go deep enough, to make room for your pain, for your shame, like John felt, for your fear and your vulnerabilities, without having to use anger as a front. John's experience as a kid was likely no different than yours and mine. He was probably told that he had nothing to be afraid of when he was afraid, nothing to be sad about when he was sad, nothing to be upset about when he was upset. You probably know that from your own childhoods. Okay, so maybe you're not suffering with a cancer diagnosis. Maybe that's extreme. But maybe there are ways, if you look closely, that anger actually does serve you. Maybe it serves to distance you from making contact, direct contact, with what you feel. So once again, I'd like to invite you to go inward with me for a moment. Let your eyes close. and bring your attention to once more to the landscape of your own heart. Just right here, in this moment, reflecting on what I know about my relationship with anger. How does it supplant my sadness? How does anger supplant my fear of being sad? Is it possible that anger is useful in easing my pent-up tensions? And maybe it helps me discharge my stress. What do I know about my anger? What does my anger allow me? What does it spare me? What is cushioned by my anger? What do I not have to tend to? What do I not have to do when I'm angry? Sogyal Rinpoche says, there's no such thing as talent, only awareness. So what we're doing is inviting this awareness to step into the angry mind, to begin to see an angry mind as just an angry mind, and to shine the light of awareness on what lies beneath it. Spiritual warriors were courageous enough to taste the suffering, relate to our fears, feel what we feel, and to see feeling as not a failure, but a purification. So inviting this awareness to reveal to us the experiences we are hiding from as an enemy. Thich Nhat Hanh writes, in us there is a river of feelings in which every drop of water is a different feeling. And each feeling relies on all the others for existence. To observe it, we just sit on the bank of the river and identify each feeling as it surfaces, as it flows by and disappears. So letting your eyes open when you're ready. Third and finally, how does uncontrolled anger destroy? How does it destroy? April 4th, 1968. Lorraine Hotel, Memphis, Tennessee. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And this event, as you recall, set off a storm of rioting around the country. D.C., Baltimore, Kansas City, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Trenton, Louisville. Uncontrolled anger became uncontrolled wildfires, literal fires around the nation. Now, many argued that those riots undermined all the progress that was made in the civil rights movement. But we don't have to debate that. That's not the point. We don't even have to go that far back to see how much damaged uncontrolled anger can do. All we have to do is examine our own lives, examine our own relationships. Examine the feelings that get hurt when we get angry. The relationships we scorch when we get angry. The things we say that we can't take back when we get angry. Anger destroys. It just destroys. And just so we're clear, we're not talking about repressing anger either. Scientists know, medical behavioral scientists now know that there are catastrophic consequences of suppressing emotion. Disastrous physical and mental consequences. So this is not the point. But repressing anger and expressing anger are at these two extremes. And neither comes to any good. So if you could reflect just for a moment on the ways that you've trained yourself, skillfully, strategically trained yourself to repress your anger until it explodes in a wildfire. Maybe someone's trying to engage with you. What's wrong, honey? Nothing. Did I say something? No. I'm fine. Rather than channel its raw power into spiritual growth, my suffering, I realized on retreat, my suffering is in my relationship to what is happening. My liberation is in my relationship to what is happening. How does my suffering, how does my anger permit me to destroy? How is it that my anger blinds me to the costs that I pay? How has it distanced me from the people that I love, the goals that I've set? What is it destroyed that I can never, ever put back together again? Try as I might, I can't do it. And I asked on the third or fourth day of that retreat, Trudy, can you drop your anger campaign? What do you think? Can you just drop it and feel what's left behind? Gandhi said, I have learnt through bitter experience the one supreme lesson: to conserve my anger. And as heat conserved is transmuted into energy, in the same way, energy controlled can be transmuted into power, which can move the world. Move the world. Our world needs our light. How? My friends, how? How can we channel this energy into raw spiritual material to move the world? One question you might be answering or asking yourself as I'm talking is, well, I hear you, but what's going to energize me to act? You know, if I give up my anger, what's going to energize me to act, to push back against oppression and the violence in the world? So from this angle, if you look at it that way, you know, passivity is what it looks like. This middle way looks passive and weak. And that's a debate that's been going on since the dawn of civilization. What becomes critical critical. If we are to do this as a people, as a country, if we are to transmute this power that is destroying each other, is destroying our natural resources, if we are to transmute it, we have got to distinguish between what really energizes us to wise action and what disguises itself as wise action. What is the difference between cultivating raw, pure, unadulterated energy to act wisely and the destructive taint of anger, which disguises itself as raw energy, but what it's really doing is hijacking the mind, hijacking the agenda. The distinction, the difference, is metta, loving kindness. As I talked about in the meditation tonight, metta is what really energizes wise action. Anger is a disguise. That's important to note. In the same way that a perennial weed is a really good disguise for a flower, chickweed, ragweed, bluegrass, knotweed, you know them? They may look like flowers, but actually they have extensive root systems that make them difficult to control and come back every single year to haunt you, don't they? Right. The more you feed anger, the deeper its root system becomes, the more difficult it is to control, and the more it keeps coming back to haunt you, year after year, decade after decade. Anger is unreliable. It's uncontrollable. And it will always, always, remember, it will always let you down. Loving kindness will lift you up. How do we transmute this anger into heat, into a power that can move the world? Gandhi, the Buddha, Jesus, Deepa Ma, there's a long, long list of wise men who knew how to tap into that real, raw, motivating energy. So I want to give you three quick tools that you can take home with you, and you can use them right away. You don't have to add water. You don't have to plant them and wait for them to grow next spring. You can use them tonight in the car on your way home. SOS. SOS. Stop. Break the angry outbreak. If you feel the anger coming on, break the angry outburst. Like a driver breaking a fast-moving chariot. Naomi Rose, I saw a card the other day with a Naomi Rose drawing, and she said, "I have found that if I am kind to myself, I am kinder to others." Can I let myself see the person I am when I'm angry? Can I see the person I'm angry at is just like me? They're just like me. They want to be happy. They have fears and doubts and worries, just like me. The Buddha said, "Those who hold back rising anger like a rolling chariot are the real charioteers. Others merely hold the reins." So when we notice ourselves teetering toward an angry outburst, we can stop. We can just stop. It may not be a pretty stop. It may not even be a full stop. But we can stop. And if you stop a couple of inches and then you go back, And you stop a little bit more and go back. If it's two steps forward and one step back, five steps forward and four steps back, it's okay. Just practice stopping. Second, observe. Seeing uncontrolled anger as an uncontrolled wildfire can be so helpful. It was helpful to me on that retreat. It's what turned it around for me. The heat that motivates us to action is useful. We need the heat. We wouldn't be here without the heat of the sun. We're in the Goldilocks zone because the universe has cooled off just enough for us to be here. Anger is not the true way to generate that motivating heat. There is heat in loving kindness. The difference is that anger is often too hot to do anything with. I poured this cup of tea just when I left the house. Happens to be a really fancy Starbucks cup, still too hot. But when it cools down, there's still heat. I can drink it when it cools down. Metta is the heat that is cooled down enough for wise action to be discernible and possible. It's the cooling down of anger. So we observe a situation from this cooled down place. And we become like the wise cook who pays attention to what the king likes. The story of the wise cook and the foolish cook. Equally good cooks. But the wise cook knew if the king left a little bit of this on the plate, the king ate all of that on the plate. We become wise and we pay attention to what the king likes. So whatever situation we're in becomes the king. And when we observe the situation from this cool place with a cool head, then we can see what actions will actually lead to reconciliation and resolution, and what actions will only lead to more strife. We can see the difference. Marcel Proust said, "All our final resolutions are made in a state of mind which is not going to last." Can we observe this? What's the other S? S-O-S, surrender. Stop, observe, surrender. The practice of metta, seeing through a lens of loving kindness and compassion and patience, allows us to master this practice of non-anger to whatever is arising. Rather than going to war with the way it is, taking sides for or against the way it is, we develop this precious capacity to surrender our anger and to move toward love first. To remember love first, to return love for abuse, the ultimate training of the bodhisattva. Conquer anger through gentleness, the Buddha wrote. Conquer unkindness through kindness. How does anger become a part of the personality? How do people develop these angry identities, these angry habits? They feed them over and over and over. How do you develop a habit, a personality of sweetness and calm and tenderness? You feed that habit over and over. You don't have to be perfect at it in the beginning, but you begin by waving the person in traffic, letting somebody go first. It becomes a part of the personality. This is what compassion looks like. So what is this transmuted world? What is it look like? once it's been transmuted by all of us. Rachel Naomi said this. This is what it looks like. She says, the reality is that healing happens between people. The wound in me evokes the healer in you. The wound in you evokes the healer in me. And then the two healers collaborate. Let's sit for a moment. Anger is fire in the mind, burning up the forest of your merits and blessings. If you want to walk the path of the Bodhisattvas, endure insults, and guard your mind against anger. I have found that if I am kind to myself, I am kinder to others. May it be so. Thank you for your kind attention tonight. There's a rare occasion that I finish with enough time to take questions. So if you have a question about the talk, question about your practice, yes, we have a taker.
Thank you. I would just love to hear you reflect for a moment on the concept of righteous anger in organizing. I kind of was thinking about that as you talked about the transmutation. So do you mind just talking a little bit more about that?
The concept of righteous anger. I mean, those two terms have been put together as if they belong together. And part of what I was hoping to do tonight was to give you another possibility that most people have associated anger with fuel that motivates action. That's fair, but it's not the only fuel that motivates wise action. In fact, it is not a good fuel for motivating wise action. It cannot motivate wise action. Anger cannot. It is not pure. It is tainted. It is a fire. And so it is the case that when the anger cools and when we can see clearly, then we know what to do. It's not as if we become passive and we don't respond to situations in our lives or in the world. We are engaged. We do become active. We do get involved. But it's in the same way that if you had to have heart surgery, open heart surgery, and there were two cardiologists all scrubbed up and ready to go, equally talented. One had just had a glass of wine and the other didn't. Which one would you choose? Right? Which one would you choose? Most people would choose the cardiologist who had not had a drink. And so anger is like this. If there's something important that you need to do, and there are important things that need to be done, wouldn't it be better to be sober, to do them? How much better would we do them from a place of sobriety, clarity, wisdom? The problem is when anger shows up on the stage, we lose clarity, we lose wisdom, and we somehow believe the myth that unless I'm angry, I will not act. The Dalai Lama, great example. Thich Nhat Hanh, they came from their respective countries and were not friendly to them at all. And they are pretty activists, pretty strong activists. But they didn't need to use anger to do it. Gandhi, the civil rights movement, you know. Proof that it's important to act, it's necessary to act. And it is better, wiser action that comes from a place, a wise heart, a wise mind that has been cooled. You can see clearly when the fog is lifted, when the anger is lifted. It's like that. It's like that. Question here? Thank you for your question.
First of all, I just want to say thank you. I thought it was a beautiful meditation.
Thank you.
You referred to the anger being projected out. I wonder if you think it's just another facet of anger, the anger that can be projected in and the contribution that makes to things like depression and a whole host of other things. Yeah.
I mean, that is the idea between a lot of the research that's happened. Fortunate for us, we do know that in a lot of cases, you could define depression as anger turned inward, inverted. And so it's, you know, we don't have a lot of training in our school systems for how to deal with matters of the heart, how to deal with emotions, how to deal with feelings. We have a lot of SAT prep, you know, we have a lot of tutors and after-school programs to help people catch up on their homework. But what is happening when we get sad, when we are lonely, when we're tired or hungry, or when we're afraid? We don't have a good system for dealing with this, addressing this. And so for a lot of people who, particularly who grew up in homes where, you know, these expressions of emotion were not timely or convenient, you know, maybe the parents worked out of the house and they didn't have time, or there were other things going on catching their attention, they didn't have room or space, you know, for these messy and inconvenient emotions to be dealt with. So they were made non-existent. It was easier to not exist. So we grow up finding strategies to distract ourselves from what seems too difficult or too inconvenient to deal with. And so for a lot of people, this looks like anxiety or trying to regulate, trying to get comfort, trying to feel okay the best way we can. And so it's learning how to stay with that emotion, with what's underneath it. We're training to increase our tolerance of what we feel, and to go into the body and ask, where am I feeling this in the body? You know, usually there is a corresponding somatic and emotional connection between mind and body. So to invite the question, where, you know, this habit of getting angry, or this habit of being judgmental, what is it? How does it benefit me? What do I gain from it? What is it? What does it cause me to avoid? What does it allow me to not deal with, not attend to? And sometimes it is the case that to be sick, you know, it lets us off the hook. It gives us the attention we need. Or to be depressed, you know, we don't have to. It's not to say that it's not a clinical disorder. It is. It's real. It's true. It's not your fault. But a lot of times we just haven't learned how to be in that soup, be in the mess, be in the heat of it. And we don't have a lot of company there, you know. You go to a hospital room and someone's terminally ill, there's not a whole lot you can do. You're not the anesthesiologist, you're not the doctor, you're not the nurse. Sometimes the best you can do is just sit there with them and hold their hand and tell them it's going to be okay and I love you. And that's what we're learning to do with ourselves, you know. Like, I don't like everything that I see come up in me, in my personality. There were things when I was, you know, starting out as a meditator, I flat out loathed about myself. But I had to learn how to be a loving guardian to myself. You know, I didn't get that from my parents necessarily, but I had to learn that, how to be more kind and gentle. You know, just before I came here tonight, I had this little jar on my desk and full of my pens, and because I sit there, I write all day. And I bumped it and hit the floor, and all the pens flew out, and I just broke into this smile. And just a few minutes later, I did it again. I hit the jar and it went to the floor and it broke into like 14 different pieces. And I broke into a laugh. You know? There was a time when I would have cursed myself. You know, called myself clumsy or, you know, there was a time. But it's with this practice of loving kindness that it's like second nature to me now. To smile at my mistakes, to be really big and open-hearted with my failures, to be like a real big sister, a sweet parent that, you know, like, it's okay, kiddo. I love you anyhow, you know, like that. It's training, it's gradual, but it's so worth it. It's so worth it. Thank you for staying.